Welcome to Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is Friday, the 26th of February, 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Well, I'm very pleased to say that tonight we have the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, Communism by the Back Door, and the Freemasonic Victors of World War II back with us tonight, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, how the devil are you?
Good evening, sir. I'm well at the moment, thank you. Obviously, the operation wasn't as successful as first believed, so probably need another one, but up to press, yeah, things are good, cool.
It's fantastic to have you back. I don't think we've spoken together for, well, at least probably about October, November last year.
I missed you, buddy. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I missed you as well. I was really worried about you for a while, and everybody was asking after you, and I thought, well, I know what I'll do. I'll send him some Get Well Soon cards, and that'll cheer him up. So I'm glad you got them.
It.
And we had lots of people stepped in to stand in for you while you were away. We had Thomas Goodrich, Didymus, Isaiah, Lady Michelle Renouf, Oka Mackenzie, Cuckslayer, and in particular Horace, who has stood in there for about the last 2 months, pretty much. He's been in there.
Brilliant.
Yeah, really, really good man. Obviously, your friend Thomas Goodrich, he started out doing a few episodes. So we're very, very grateful to them for stepping in and standing in. And also we've got another bit of good news as well. While you were away, The Greatest Story Never Told was made available on DVD once again, which
I'll just say, like, the old website, the people who run that website, I haven't heard from for well over a year now, which is a concern, because there were people of high standard, very honorable. And then suddenly, bang, I heard nothing. I've had no contact. So for a long time, it was stagnant. But now we do have the DVD back on sale again. Yeah.
And people can purchase that from moneytreepublishing.com. It's just $50 for the 4-disc set. And it's also advertised at radioalbion.com. If you go to the TWO Films logo in the sidebar there. I guess while you've been away, I mean, you must have been too tired to do any work, Dennis. I take it the body count, Churchill's body count, I take it, is that still to be finished?
That's still to be finished. And not only were I not really, strength of mind to do that, the PC played up as well, so I had to use another computer, and then I had to have this one wiped back to the beginning. But thankfully, I have discovered all the Churchill parts. So I'll commence on it shortly.
So you've still got all the content there, and you can get those chapters finished. And also, you've been looking up some information on Trotsky. You've provided all the notes for us to do a series on Trotsky, which I'm very, very pleased with. That helps me out there with getting these notes. And that's from the Scarlet and the Beast book.
Yeah. And the reason I chose Trotsky is because I didn't even know when he died. I thought he died in the 1920s. I didn't realise it was far later. And one or two other people asked were of the same. They didn't really know that much about him other than what we're told about his involvement in overturning Russia and Russian Revolution and being killed by Stalin or Stalin's KGB men. So, yeah, I thought, well, I think it's a subject which people would like to know more about.
Oh, definitely. We talk about communism a lot, and we talk about the revolution, and we talk about the horrors of communism and the famines and the NKVD and the Cheka. And we mention the names of these people, but we don't really go into very much detail about these characters. So, yeah, I'm pleased that you picked Trotsky, and it would probably take us two or three episodes to get through all of this. And as you say, you're taking it from the book Scarlet and the Beast, A History of the War Between English and French Freemasonry by John Daniel. And this was published in 1995. And obviously it's going to concentrate on Masonic links and show the conspiratorial side to this. But also we'll learn a bit about what went on at the start of the communist revolution. And because Britain features in this as well, Trotsky was in Britain for a while. It seems that a lot of these, a lot of these anarchists and these communists and these Jewish exiles, they would leave Russia and then they would come to Britain. I know that there was a lot of trouble with these anarchists, so-called Russian anarchists, around about 1900.
Yeah, I've been watching Peaky Blinders lately, and that's a series on Netflix where there's a lot of communist activity in Birmingham around about just after World War One.
Well, that's good that they're covering that. I don't know how truthful it will be, but at least it makes people aware of it. Well, let's have a look at Trotsky here then. His real name is Lev Davidovich Bronstein. He was born in 1879 and he died in 1940. He was assassinated by the NKVD. He was born to Jewish parents, which means he was a Jew. His father was a wealthy grain mill owner in Kherson, South Russia, and owned an estate at Yanovka, which lies not far from Kherson. Bronstein's views were identical to that of the Alliance Israelite Universelle, which proposed the involvement of Jews in all walks of Gentile society. But he showed no evidence of being anti-Zionist. To hide his years of revolutionary activity, Bronstein changed his name to Leon D. Trotsky. And this is interesting because we tend to forget this as well. There were two strands in Jewry back then. There was a strand that was pro-Zionist that wanted Jews to not assimilate in the countries that they were in and wanted them to have a homeland of their own. It was essentially a nationalist movement saying, you know, you shouldn't want to be like these Gentiles. You should want to be like a Jew and you should want to live with other Jews in a Jewish homeland. And that was one movement, and that was Zionism. And then you had this other movement, which was communism, which was anti-religion. So it was really anti the Jewish religion, but it wanted to take over the world and it wanted to abolish nationalities. And the Jews that were involved in it did see it as Jews being able to work their way to the top and they would be controlling things. And the communists were essentially against the Zionists because they didn't want their Jews to leave and go to Israel. They wanted them to stay and be part of communism. So people forget that.
We find a similar battle was going on between Trump and other sections of society on Biden's side, which is pretty much similar to what you're talking about there.
Yeah, I think they have Wall Street and J Street. Is that what they
That's
call
right.
it? You get the left-wing Jews and the right-wing Jews.
Correct.
And I mean, Israel is a right wing state. And you can complain about the way they treat the Palestinians, but for the way that they actually treat the Jewish people, they're probably pretty good. You know, it's the only ethnic state there is.
Not the coloured ones.
I guess what they say, well, you're not actually of Jewish ethnicity. They're just of Jewish religion, aren't they? So I guess that comes into it. So originally Trotsky had these views that came from the Alliance Israelite Universelle, which was saying that Jews should assimilate and they should become like the people that they live among. And Trotsky became, he wanted to lead the people that he lived among as a revolutionary. And he did become like, he led these communist movements all over the place in London, in Austria, and in Russia. I guess this is the thing with Jews. It doesn't matter where they are. They end up supporting these movements and they end up rising to the top. We've talked about that a lot, actually, myself and Horace over the last few weeks. We did a series on that sort of thing. And we'll hear about that with Trotsky here. Well, most people first learned of Trotsky's existence and activities in 1917 when he entered the political arena in Russia and presented himself as the intimate friend and co-worker of Lenin. Only those more closely acquainted with Marxist movements and revolutionary propaganda in Europe remembered that Trotsky and Lenin were actually enemies in earlier years. Trotsky, at age 19, used the secrecy of the Grand Orient Lodges to organise a revolutionary society in Nikolaev, a port on the Black Sea near his home. Many poor and deceived Protestants who felt they had been persecuted by the Orthodox Church of Russia were easy recruits for his Masonic revolution. and the seeds of discontent began to germinate as he succeeded in perverting the meetings of these Russian Protestant Christians to socialism. In 1899, he and a number of his Masonic friends were arrested by the Tsar's police and exiled to Siberia. But he escaped in 1902 and fled to Western Europe. Trotsky was merely one of many Russian political emigrants who were then populating the back alleys of European capitals. Eventually, he went to London, where he had occasion to visit with Lenin, who was himself travelling abroad in search of funding. Trotsky, not yet willing to yield to the violent overthrow of government as demanded by Lenin's Bolsheviks, avoided Lenin's suggestion that they unite. And they hadn't actually fallen out at this point. This is when Trotsky first came across him. And when Trotsky was actually exiled to Siberia, this was for his propaganda activities. He was actually a journalist. And another thing that this story tells us is the power of propaganda and how important it is. Do you want to comment on any of this, Dennis?
It's surprising that Trotsky's, he ended up, as we'll find out, as being a pretty violent person with violent followers. So at the moment, as you're reading now, he's kind of not going down that road. He's going more down the, you know, opposite to what Lenin is preaching. So that's an interesting one, because he actually formed the Red Army and organized all the Bolshevik movement.
Eventually he did, and at the time it was Lenin who had the Bolsheviks, and the Bolsheviks were involved in bank robberies and all sorts. They were thugs and hooligans, and Trotsky was the Mensheviks, and he was a more of an intelligentsia, I guess, and he was saying what we need to do is we need to get the workers of the world to rise up and have a revolution. And he was going to use his propaganda to get all the Germans and the British and the French, all the workers, to rise up and take over the factories and take over the means of production. And he was going to use propaganda for that. And that was what the Mensheviks wanted to do. And then you had the Bolsheviks who said, no, we need to use violence to do this.
Just wipe out the middle class.
Yeah. that's what they ended up doing. So they didn't. You know, they hadn't fallen out at this time. They just met, but they had these two different ideas about how to go about things. From London, Trotsky went to Austria and then to Paris. While in Paris, he frequented the Grand Orient Lodges, soliciting financial and political support for his own revolution. There, he was encouraged by the more radical communists to reconsider violence if the milder form of workers' strikes did not prove successful. As a Marxist, Trotsky succeeded in winning the confidence of the leaders of Marxism in Paris, and from then on we find him closely associated with the two Masonic headquarters of the Russian Revolution. Thus, it was in London and in Paris that Trotsky got his real start as an international figure. And I guess this fills in because we're used to hearing about how he was on this train and he was in New York and he somehow got put on a train and then he ended up in Russia, but we don't often hear about what happened before then, do we?
No, that's true. Yeah. It's kind of hidden, isn't it? Hidden history.
And this Masonic connection as well.
Yeah, well, there was forces, Masonic forces, both inside and outside the Soviet Union working towards overthrowing the Tsar.
And at the same time, we've got this English Freemasonry working supposedly against French Freemasonry. Can you tell us about that?
Well, there's a rivalry, isn't there? Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about that, Dennis?
Yeah, well, it's something I discovered not long ago, where I used to look at Freemasonry as a whole, where once you realised that the English Freemasonry, which is based in London headquarters, and then the French Freemasonry, Grand Orient, are two separate entities, but all Freemasons. And a lot of history throughout the years, a lot of events, historical events, has been caused by this clash of English and French Freemasonry. It's a fascinating subject.
So they're vying for supremacy, and Trotsky was in there with the Grand Orient Freemasons. With blessings from the French Grand Orient, he was sent back to Russia to foment revolution. He arrived in the spring of 1905 and founded a daily newspaper, the Nachalo, The Beginning. Shortly thereafter, he formed the Soviet of Workers in St. Petersburg. Lenin, who had returned to Russia soon after Trotsky, took no active part in the Soviets, but he satisfied himself with editing his own radical revolutionary daily called Novaya Zhizn. And I'm just trying to think of the name of the Soviet that he had there. It wasn't the Comintern. Lenin's one was the Comintern. I think that was the First International, the Soviet of Workers, because this was his idea, was that we needed internationalism. You needed all the workers to unite around the fact they were workers and forget about the borders. And that was his idea. So that, again, that was another bit that I guess that he clashed a little bit with Lenin on. Although these two men would cooperate in the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution, Lenin was Trotsky's rival, and not only politically, but journalistically as well. Trotsky's newspaper had a much larger circulation than did Lenin's, up to 500,000 copies daily. And Trotsky was also backed financially by a wealthy Jewish publisher, Dr. Herzenstein. Lenin's circulation was much smaller and wielded much less influence. And I guess we can see here why our opponents get so worried about us on the internet and with people looking at our live streams, because they know how important getting that information out there is, because that's what they use to get to the positions that they got to today.
That's right, yeah. It's control of the media. Like the Pravda is another paper which is prominent in the communist world when Stalin was in charge.
That was Stalin's one. So you got Lenin's one, you got Trotsky's one, and you got Stalin's one. All putting out their view
the
on
the media. Yeah.
A Pravda is Russian for the truth.
Really?
quite bold, isn't it? Calling yourself the truth. at least we call this podcast Truth Will Out. We're not actually calling ourselves the truth. Well, both papers, however, reached Germany, where they were read by the House of Warburg. Max Warburg, a Grand Orient Freemason and banker, had already been observing both men and was presently assisting them geopolitically by funding the Japanese war against Russia. Trotsky's publication made Warburg aware that this rebel's viewpoint on world revolution was identical to his own. Warburg knew that a man like Trotsky would go far in solidifying a revolution if properly supported and supplied with plenty of money. But to run a revolutionary government was not his strength, and for this Warburg chose the more intellectual Lenin. Trotsky and Lenin's future cooperation undoubtedly was encouraged by the House of Warburg. So here we see something else that's coming into this. We see this banker here, this Max Warburg, and he's having an influence on this war, the Japanese war against Russia.
Weakening
Russia, so he knows that Russia is getting weaker and weaker, and you've also got the First World War that's going on at the time. So he's thinking, well, Russia is ripe for a revolution now. It's getting very weak, and all it would take is a small push to push it over, and we'll get Trotsky to do that. So Max Warburg obviously had something against Russia anyway, and I believe that was to do with accusations against the Tsar and the way that he had treated the Jews, something like that.
I think it was something to do with the American Civil War as well. They had a certain influence down there, which I don't think was ever forgiven.
Yeah, I know something ties in with America. May have been an assassination or something, that may have been the response to it. May have been an assassination before the actual assassination of the Tsar. Maybe I have to try and find that out for next week. The Bolshevik movement did not originate with the poor and downtrodden of Russia, as we have been led to believe, but by wealthy Grand Orient Freemasons from Berlin and Paris and affluent left-wing English Masons from London. So that brings in the English Mason side of it, and the Grand Orient Mason side of it. That's been involved since the French Revolution, hasn't it? They were the ones on the left. And the Jacobins.
That's right.
And they were the really nasty left-wing anarchist types.
Yeah, they got kicked out, didn't they? And well, British or English Freemasonry was formed, and they moved on then to France.
So originally we had this English masonry, and then that split, and the left-wing lot moved over to France.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've got here is we've also got a left-wing English Masons in London that are getting involved in this as well.
Yeah, well, I would presume there's left and right there at some stage.
In Trotsky and the Jews Behind the Russian Revolution, written anonymously in 1937 by one of Trotsky's former Soviet commissars, we read, "The ties between Trotsky and the powers backing him doubtless became closer after the 1905 revolution. As factual head of the St. Petersburg Workers' Soviet, he had demonstrated his disregard for all restraint when offered an opportunity to stir mobs of criminals into a bloodthirsty frenzy." So two things there about how he had powerful financial backers, and also how he became incredibly violent, and he was known for stirring mobs up into a bloodthirsty frenzy.
Reminds me of Churchill.
Yeah. The inability of the worker strikes to topple the government forced Trotsky to rethink his style of revolution, and he finally agreed with Lenin that a successful revolution must maintain a constant slaughter of undesirables, a never-ending reign of terror. So what
that's the red terror, yeah, what always follows.
So what they started out doing here, they started out having all these strikes, and they ended up having a little bit of a revolution, but it failed. And with the failure of the 1905 revolution, Trotsky was again exiled to Siberia. But hardly had he been brought to his destination when he escaped, hurrying back to St. Petersburg, where he was hidden by his Masonic comrades. After a short stay, he then left Russia on a mission to tour Europe, speaking in one city and then another, always just ahead of the police. He also played the role of correspondent for influential Russian and European newspapers and periodicals that were distributed on the continent. Meanwhile, in Paris, aristocratic Russians who had been exiled to France after the first Duma was dissolved in the summer of 1906 were preparing their own Masonic revolution. Mackey's Encyclopedia of Freemasonry gives us the details. A few prominent Russian intellectuals joined French lodges. Professor Bajanov joined at Paris the Scottish Rite Lodge, Les Amis Runis. Paul Jablokov, world-famous electrician, founded the Lodge Cosmos under the ancient accepted Scottish Rite at Paris, where in 1906 about 15 Russian publicists joined French lodges. These brethren, on their return to Russia, organised two lodges, one in St. Petersburg, the Polar Star, and a lodge at Moscow. These lodges were instituted with great ceremony in May 1908 by two representatives of the Grand Orient of France, and up to 1909, six lodges were organised. There was an interval in their activity over police restrictions, and then these lodges were reopened in 1911, working under the Grand Orient of France, with practically no ritual and having an avowedly political aim in view, namely that of the overthrow of autocracy. In 1913 and 1914, the organisation had about 42 lodges, chiefly composed of members of the Cadet Party. The first revolution in March 1917 is said to have been inspired and operated from these lodges, and all the members of Kerensky's government belonged to them. So the first government that they actually put in place after the 1917 revolution, which was in February, they were all Masons from these lodges, and that was who was put in power. So this idea that it was a workers' revolution, the workers aren't going to put a load of Masons in power, are they?
No, well, in The Secret Masonic Victory of World War II, I cover the Russian Revolution. And like they did, if you remember, when the Reichstag fell, they filmed the day after, you know, Russians taking over. They did the same with the Russian Revolution, where it looks like they've attacked it and they've broken in and there's fighting, when in fact they actually filmed the next day on the day that all this really did happen. There was just one broken window and a few scratches.
Oh, they were very clever with their filming, aren't they? It's like when they went into liberate Auschwitz, and then they went back there.
All the Hollywood guys in.
Yeah, they went, then they went back there 6 months later, and it was in the winter, and it was snowing, and they filmed it. And then on the BBC last year, they had a Holocaust survivor, and they were showing her this film, and she was saying that that wasn't how it happened. It wasn't snowing. No, that wasn't how it happened at all.
Yeah, it's not difficult to manipulate.
Yeah, I think the BBC were a bit surprised at that. Yeah, it was the Soviets had gone back there to actually make a film out of it and pretend that that was what actually happened.
Mm.
Well, the outbreak of World War One found Trotsky in Austria, editing the revolutionary paper Pravda. Grand Orient Freemasons had already assassinated Archduke Ferdinand, and Masons had made inroads into Austrian politics, with many Austrian police being Freemasons. Instead of confining Trotsky, as they had done with other Russian subjects, the police warned him to leave Austria as quickly as possible. He moved on to Paris, leaving behind a library and many revolutionary manuscripts. These documents were preserved by the Masonic Lodge at Vienna, and later sent to Russia after the Bolshevik Revolution. So you can see the links that these lodges are making.
Yeah, I can remember when King Ferdinand was killed, the guy who did it was a member of the Black Hand, which obviously is the time with the Masons.
And we have, like, the Masons are operating like as if they're not a part of the nation that they're in, are they? They're working together as Masons.
Right.
Rather than working as Austrians or as French, this internationalist idea. From Paris, Trotsky travelled to Switzerland, where Lenin was already in residence, and in 1915, the Third International, commonly known as the Communist International, began to take on a more definite form. So this first one was the one that I mentioned earlier, the first Soviet thing that they mm-hmm. called it. And now they're actually calling it the International, the Third International. From Switzerland, Trotsky moved to Spain, but when the Russian government notified the Spanish authorities that he was there, he was again arrested. Masons in Madrid contacted London to assist, but English Freemasonry, planning its own revolution in Russia, refused to help Trotsky. Strange as it may seem, Trotsky was then exiled to New York City. So there must have been something going on. I'd like to know more about what the English plan for revolution in Russia was that was foiled by the French.
I think that was a Rothschild, that.
It was a Rothschild plan. Right. So you had the Rothschilds planning something and you had the Warburgs.
Yeah, rivalry there.
Yeah. By this time, Trotsky had become quite famous in Russian Jewish revolutionary circles. This is in New York. When he stepped off the ship, a reception committee of Russian Jews with flowers and music greeted him. There he was introduced to Grand Orient Freemason Jacob Schiff, the financial protege of the German Grand Orient Masons Felix and Max Warburg. Schiff immediately placed Trotsky in the editorial offices of the radical Russian newspaper Novy Mir, New World, which was then published in New York. It was now 1916. So he certainly gets about, doesn't he?
Yeah, say someone who's not really working.
Yeah, all across Europe and off there to New York. Instead of being put in jail as well, mind.
Yeah, he's getting away with things.
So he was saved from being sent to jail by the Masons and the police wherever he was arrested.
Well, that probably goes on anyway today, doesn't it? Because the Masons, well, the police especially, are tied in with Masonry. And if you've got people in their places of power, then you're going to escape jail.
Well, English Freemasonry and the Rothschilds may have surprised their German-American rivals with the February-March coup by the Duma. So what that must be referring to there is that the first revolution, the February Revolution that they had, which is when you were saying about those other Masons were all put in place, the first government that they actually had in Russia with this February Revolution. So that must have been the English one. But anti-Zionist Jacob Schiff and those allied with him, namely the Warburgs of New York and Hamburg, were not caught unprepared. As head of the Kaiser's Secret Service, Max Warburg immediately began to plan a counter-revolution, and an emergency meeting was called in the Grand Orient Lodge at Hamburg. Coded cables between Hamburg and New York crisscrossed the Atlantic as Schiff was ordered, prepare Trotsky. Lenin, still in Switzerland, was told to meet Trotsky at St. Petersburg, where further instructions would follow. Myron Fagan picks up the story. Right from the outset of Kerensky's revolution, strange and mysterious goings-on were taking place in New York. Night after night, Trotsky darted furtively in and out of Jacob Schiff's palatial mansion, and in the dead of those same nights, there were gatherings of hoodlums on New York's Lower East Side, all of them Russian refugees at Trotsky's headquarters, and all were going through some mysterious sort of training process, but it was all shrouded in mystery. Nobody talked, although it did leak out that Schiff was financing all of Trotsky's activities. Then suddenly, Trotsky vanished, as did approximately 300 of his trained hoodlums. Actually, they were on the high seas in a Schiff-chartered ship bound for a rendezvous with Lenin. In Switzerland, Lenin was feted with a farewell party in his Masonic hideaway. Myron Fagan continues, men of the very highest places in the world were guests at that party. One of them was Max Warburg of the Warburg banking clan in Germany, whose family financed the Kaiser's war machine and who the Kaiser had regarded by making Max chief of the secret police of Germany. And this explains why the Germans allowed the train to carry on going to Russia when it got stopped, doesn't it?
That's right.
They knew what it was carrying, but the Germans were at war with the Russians. So I guess the English Masons had had their Kerensky Revolution, the Duma Revolution, that replaced all the government. And then next we're going to get the Bolshevik Revolution, which is the one that ended up murdering the Tsar.
It didn't happen straight away. I think Kerensky just handed the keys over to when Lenin arrived. There was no mass fighting. That came a little bit later on once the White Russians could see what was going on.
It's always better the devil you know. You know, these revolutions, you know, if there's any blood that is spilled, then you're going to end up worse off. That's what I've learned. I can think of two revolutions that actually improved the lot of the people, and both of them, there was no blood spilled, and that was the Green Revolution in Libya with Gaddafi, and the National Socialist Revolution, where the National Socialists were voted into power, and then they had their revolution. And both of those improved a lot of the people, but everything else, the French Revolution, the Communist Revolution, South American revolutions, you know, it's just putting the worst people in power.
Well, you've got to remember the statement, what Masons stand by, we make good men better.
And who was it that said that?
No, that's some kind of a standard Mason saying when they're pushing for people to join. So when you look at Lenin and Stalin and Trotsky and the rest,
that's the sort of
they make them better at what? War.
English Freemasonry was also aware of Trotsky's movements, in part through their White House mole, Colonel House, and also by British intelligence surveillance of Trotsky in New York. When Trotsky, with his band of 300 terrorists, set sail for Russia, his ship was intercepted and taken into custody by a British warship off the coast of Canada. He and his band were detained in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and brought to the nearby Amherst prison camp. The British Rothschild Masonic Alliance underestimated Jacob Schiff and his German-American Grand Orient allies. Schiff, through Freemason Colonel House, rushed instructions to President Wilson to order the British to release the ship intact with Trotsky's hoodlums. Wilson obeyed, warning the British that if they refused, the United States would not enter the war, and the British buckled to US pressure while the United States entered the war on April the 6th. The British kept their part of the bargain, and Trotsky was set free on April the 29th, 1917. Now, I do wonder here, Dennis, because we've also got Balfour Agreement, with Israel. And it was said that the United States promised to go into the war, or the Jews promised that they would get United States to go into the war if Britain was to give the Jews Palestine. So how does this how does this bit fit into this? How would the Jews have been able to get America to go into the war if Britain hadn't done that?
Well, it explains it a little bit further on, but certainly you got the American Jews, that are the bankers, who were in a control of the situation, said, well, we won't come in the war unless our boys go free. And Britain obviously was losing the war and so needed the US to come in besides the Balfour Agreement. And so they gave in.
It's interesting, isn't it? The in both instances, the Jews are able to say, look, we have that much influence now with the United States. We can say whether they're going to enter the war or not. And Britain both times buckled to them and said, okay, we'll do what you wish.
Yeah, well like I said, they were losing, or in great danger of losing that war. I know Germany was winning the war, but actually wanted peace, but Britain never actually go along with any peace declarations.
Trotsky then proceeded to Russia, stopping at Stockholm to pick up a $20 million Warburg bank draft. Meanwhile, Max Warburg prepared Lenin's transport while Lenin and his group of communist terrorists were loaded into a sealed freight car and carried across German territory to Russia at the height of World War One. I mean, it's like they were chemical weapons or bio-warfare, isn't it? Sealed into a freight car and just sent out of Europe into Russia to explode once they got there. The imagery of that, they were sealed into the freight car, this deadly cargo that was being sent in. On November the 5th, 1919, Winston Churchill, a third-degree Mason, admitted to the House of Commons in camouflaged terms that Freemasonry was behind Lenin's revolution. Lenin was sent into Russia in the same way that you might send a phial containing a culture of typhoid or of cholera to be poured into the water supply of a great city, and it worked with amazing accuracy. No sooner did Lenin arrive than he began beckoning a finger here and a finger there to obscure persons in sheltered retreats in New York, in Glasgow, in Bern, and other countries, and he gathered together the leading spirits of a formidable sect, the most formidable sect in the world. And it stops there. It doesn't actually define which sect he's talking about.
Well, can I just go back just a second? Back to the Winston Churchill, a third-degree Mason, admitting the House of Commons in camouflage terms. That's exactly what Roosevelt did when he brought out this pyramid on the back of the dollar and was talking about this new world. These are messages were to be sent out, and people in the know, people in Freemasonry especially, understand what the camouflage terms mean. So it is an organization which is not beneficial to what people believe is democracy.
I think that might be referred to as twilight language.
Could well be.
Possibly. Well, several years after Trotsky's brutal slaughter of Russians, Londoners began to question why the British had released him. In 1924, J.D. Dell, a prominent London publisher, sent a letter to Lloyd George, Prime Minister of Great Britain from 1916 to 1922, asking him for an answer. Part of Dell's letter reads, "It is clear enough now, as you are aware, that the revolution in Russia in 1917 was no mere spontaneous rising of the masses, but was deliberately engineered, both from within and without Russia, by her inveterate enemies. Germany has been accused of aiding Russia's enemies in this bloody business by the dispatch of Lenin's secret train, but so far no accusation has been made against this country, England, in connection with Trotsky's passage from America to Russia. Germany has an excuse. She was at war with Russia. But what excuse have we? To help the torture of a wartime ally in the way we helped to torture Russia is a crime of such magnitude that it would be impossible to expiate it voluntarily, but we must try. In order to attain the object mentioned in the beginning of the letter, to acquit the conscience of Britain and to bring the chief perpetrators to book, kindly let me know whether you accept any responsibility for the release of Trotsky from his arrest in Halifax, NS, or his passage through to Russia. As head of the British government at the time, you are, of course, officially responsible. If, however, you disclaim responsibility, it is necessary for you to indicate where this lies. Dell never received an answer to his letter, although silence suggests complicity with Trotsky's communist revolution. That was not the case. Lloyd George could not defend his decision to release Trotsky without implicating English Freemasonry's role in funding Kerensky's socialist revolution to keep Russia in the war. Nor could he reveal London's negotiations with American Jews to lobby for America's entry into the war. Lloyd George hated the communists as much as did Dell, but to release Trotsky was a matter of national survival, requiring no explanation. So that lays it all out there, doesn't it? They wanted to keep Russia in the war. That was why they got this Kerensky socialist revolution. But then the response to that was the German Freemasons sending Trotsky in there to take Russia down.
Yeah.
There's a lot of intrigue, isn't there?
It's skullduggery at its best.
Yeah, that's the right word. I mean, it makes more sense now that we hear this. There's probably background to this, which is earlier in the book, which explains more of it. After Trotsky's arrival in Russia, he and Lenin joined hands for the first time at Petrograd in May 1917 with the bandit Joseph Stalin at their side, 1 month after America entered the First World War. And I'll just stop there and say, calling Joseph Stalin a bandit, they're not saying that as an insult. He was a literal bandit. He was a bank robber.
Bank robber, yeah.
That was his job, basically. He was a bank robber and a bandit.
Raising funds.
Yeah, fundraising for the communists. Immediately, they set out to solidify control. With $20 million at their disposal, Lenin put on a powerful propaganda campaign to replace Kerensky and his provisional government with a nationwide system of Soviets or councils. A series of attacks were then directed at the financially entrenched Rothschilds and their newly created Republican government. The first blow was aimed directly at the Russian army and navy. Such a move was necessary for two reasons, wrote the commissar. First, to deprive rival revolutionary parties of the possibility of preventing anarchy, and second, to defeat the more conservative, moderate aims of the Rothschilds. That's interesting, isn't it, that the Rothschilds are almost on the better side here, aren't they?
I have to admit, but yeah.
Not used to hearing that, are we?
Not at all.
What Lenin and Trotsky needed was an army of the proletariat, and this they had to create. The middle class, who were mostly agreeable to Kerensky's socialistic views, were reluctant to side with the radical proletarians, who fiercely embraced the Grand Orient communist doctrine. Lenin and Trotsky had to build the foundation for their dictatorship of the proletariat by using the downtrodden underdogs of civilization, as the Marxist gospel called the criminals and parasites of society. So I should imagine they probably tried to break into the prisons and let the prisoners out.
Yeah, well, I think they did at one stage, yeah. Which is, like I said, it's very similar to Churchill in Ireland, where he emptied the jails to go over to Ireland, you know, when they were fighting the IRA.
And they did the same in Saudi Arabia, didn't they, to send them into Syria to take down Bashar al-Assad.
Yes,
offered, what was it, the commiseration of their sentence, or whatever the word is of their sentence for any criminal that said that they would go and fight in Syria.
They
got given a pardon.
That's it.
And sent them into Libya as well, one of these accusations.
Yeah.
And I think the first thing when they have the revolution, is they open up the prisons, isn't it, as well, and let them all out.
Yeah, well, that causes chaos, doesn't it? And the more chaos, what's going on, you know, the easier. It's very true what comes after every revolution, even the French Revolution. It's a means of controlling, by fear, the population of a country. Now, in Libya's case, you know, they raped the girls and daughters and left the heads, cut off the heads, left them in the fridge at night for the parents to find. These horrible acts of violence goes a long way to controlling a population. People tend to keep quiet.
I should imagine they're in a, just in a state of shock, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
And don't forget, they've also neutralized the they've neutralized the police or the army and the navy. I don't think they really had a police back then, but they've neutralized the army and the navy, so there's nobody that can come in to protect the people. So mm-hmm. I guess what they would do is they would brutalize the people and then say, and we're the only people that can protect you, so you need to suck up to us, otherwise we're going to brutalize you all the more. And then they'll do
Unless you're middle class anyway, you're going to get it.
Yeah, they're not going to fight back then, are they? I mean, that's exactly. That's how the bullies work, isn't it?
Yeah, it's fear. It's fear and intimidation.
The Commissar, using the French Revolution and the storming of the Bastille as an example of the Bolsheviks' tactic, explained how Lenin and Trotsky recruited this element. When the slums, alleys, taverns, brothels and inns of the cities and villages were unable to supply the needed majorities for the Soviets, the jails of the country and Siberia's convict colonies had to produce them. So they even put the criminals in charge. That's who they put into these Soviets. All the criminals and thugs.
I can remember Ernst Sundel's wife talking. She was like a German descent, and I think they moved to the Russia into Russia. Her, I think
Mennonites they were, weren't they?
Mennonites. That's the word I was looking for. Yeah. So, and she was saying that at the time there was great chaos because they opened up the prisons there, and no one was safe.
Well, the good guys were being sent to the prisons, weren't they?
Or being killed, yeah.
Because that was what was happening to Ernst Sundel's wife. She'd been put on a train and was being sent to Siberia, and the Germans came in and they stopped the trains.
Stopped the trains, yeah.
And rescued
them. Which worries me in the UK, because if ever it comes to a point where we are at a revolutionary stage and they did open the prisons, they're full of Muslims. And they've been locked up for so long. They've seen the Muslim countries being bombed by the West, and they haven't had sex for a number of years, so two and two make four.
And we also got a lot of them in the army now as well. I mean, you really would think that the British would have learned the number of times out in India where they had natives in the troops, and the natives would rebel.
And same in Afghanistan.
And recently in Afghanistan and in America, you've got all these problems with these Chinese spies. They're reaching out to the Chinese and saying, come and join the CIA. And they just feed back all the information back to China. And Britain's doing it now. I saw the other day a headline about how Britain is proudly opening up MI5 and MI6 to the world. They want to recruit people that aren't British to British intelligence. And where is the intelligence
world,
in that?
One world order.
Ludicrous. Right, where do we get to here? The uprising at Petrograd. In July 1917, Trotsky's new army created an uprising at Petrograd. No one suspected a counter-revolution against Kerensky. Indeed, the Russian people had hoped that someday, perhaps after the end of the war, a bloodless revolution might occur, and that such a revolution would result in lasting liberal reforms for the country, and they hoped that Kerensky would fulfil that dream. They were not prepared for, and nor did they want, the bloodthirsty Bolshevik revolution. The uprising at Petrograd was ostensibly in protest at Romanov's participation in the provisional government, and consequently the uprising led to the resignation of Prince Lvov. In an effort to gain control of the situation, Knight said that Kerensky took over as prime minister and appointed exclusively Masons to the government. So this first revolution must have been fairly peaceful, and the Russian people were hoping that this Kerensky was going to do okay. And then his attempt at stopping the second revolution was to appoint Masons to all the important positions. Interesting.
Yeah.
And also, the Russian people really, really liked the Tsar, but it was being portrayed in the world's media that the Tsar was oppressing them.
Yeah.
And he was a bad guy. And in actual fact, he was really good. And you can see that today with the honor that they pay to the Tsar. And they're looking, they're having an investigation into his assassination, aren't they, finally, over the last couple of years.
They're in a swamp, I think, where they found the bodies.
According to Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson, it was a ritualistic killing, the way that they were killed, killing of the king. Shortly thereafter, the first general election for the first constitutional assembly took place. Both the socialists and the communists campaigned. Lenin's Bolsheviks were clearly in the minority. Soundly defeated, the Bolsheviks retaliated by staging their October Revolution, in which they killed, jailed, or exiled the rightfully elected representatives of the people. What that is saying is during that February Revolution, that they did have a few Bolsheviks in the government, but not enough. So that added to this as well when they had this second revolution. The Bolsheviks did not grow rapidly, but they did win over two local military contingents in two chief cities. Dr. Quigley gives the details of the situation. On November the 7th, 1917, the Bolshevik group seized the centres of government in St. Petersburg and was able to hold them because of the refusal of the local military contingents to support the provisional government. Within 24 hours, this revolutionary group issued a series of decrees which abolished the provisional government, ordered the transfer of all public authority in Russia to Soviets made up of workers, soldiers and peasants, set up a central executive of the Bolshevik leaders called the Council of People's Commissars, and ordered the end of the war with Germany and the distribution of large landholdings to the peasants. The Bolsheviks had no illusions about their position in Russia at the end of 1917. They knew that they formed an infinitesimal group in that vast country and that they had been able to seize power because they were a decisive and ruthless minority amongst a great mass of persons who had been neutralised by propaganda. So even though they were a tiny minority, the power of those newspapers that they had set up had sort of primed the people for this to happen. So they were in a state of shock. In April 1919, while Trotsky was still in his glory and before Stalin came to power, M. Cohen, the Jewish editor of The Communist, a Russian newspaper, wrote, "One can say without exaggeration that the great Russian social revolution has been made by the hand of the Jews. With the sombre, oppressed masses of Russian workmen and peasants have been capable by throwing themselves off, have been capable by themselves of throwing off the yoke of the bourgeoisie. No, it was especially the Jews who have led the Russian proletariat to the dawn of the international and who have not only guided but still guide today in 1919 the cause of the Soviets, which they have preserved in their hands. We can sleep in peace so long as the commander-in-chief of the Red Army is Comrade Trotsky. Jews bravely lead to victory the masses of the Russian proletariat." So they really weren't shy in talking about the fact that this was all led by Jews at the time. Mm-hmm. And of course, it gets brushed under the carpet today, doesn't it? They don't really want people to find out about it.
Well, I don't think they really teach much at schools about the Russian Revolution anyway. It's hardly ever mentioned.
Well, this is the reason why, isn't it? Is because when you look into it, there was a large Jewish influence.
Yeah, when the Jews moved to America, there was a certain element from Russia which were very political and agitating. So it's the same crowd, you know, the rich streetwise.
Well, and also in America, they weren't able to carry out a revolution there, but they managed to get involved in the propaganda, didn't they, with the media and Hollywood. Promoting all the communist ideas there. Well, shortly after the October Revolution, Trotsky accepted the position of Commissar of War and took over the military forces of the Soviets, calling them the Workers and Soldiers Soviets. And don't forget, a lot of them are criminals, and yet he's defining them as being workers and soldiers. And these are prisoners and criminals and thugs and hooligans. And also Jews who were very who were angry against the Russians. There were a lot of Jews in the Red Army.
Yeah.
They wanted people that really didn't care about anybody else and had no loyalties to anybody else. The opposite of...
Yeah, they found them.
Yeah, well, it's the opposite of, you know, who you would really want in an army. You know, really you would want the army to be made up of people that loved their country, loved their nation and was willing to lay down their lives. But what the Soviets wanted were people that hated the nation, hated humanity, and were going to do the most twisted and sick things. The Soviets consisted primarily of unscrupulous criminals, many of whom, it appears, had been initiated into the Ordo Templi Orientis. This barbarous Red Army, as it called itself, joined remnants of the Russian army and the navy. According to historian Richard Pipes, in Russia under the Bolshevik regime, written in 1993, the Red Army adopted in 1918 as its emblem the Masonic five-pointed star or pentagram. To strengthen his forces, Trotsky conscripted the entire male population and tried to restore some sort of military discipline. Now, I asked Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson about this. What is the origin of this five-pointed star? And he said, most people say that it is of Masonic origin, but they obviously had some other kind of thing that they could link it to. And he said it may have been the five continents, because it was supposed to be international, so it represented the five continents.
Well, it's funny because it's the same thing with in Texas. You know, they have the star in Texas. And during the Alamo, you know, they had the Masons. David Crockett was a Mason. And most of the other leaders there in the fort. And then after the Alamo, they had some more battles. And it was a Masonic state, which finally defeated the Mexican army.
It's quite barefaced, isn't it? It's like with the French Revolution when they had their motto, equality, something or other, and fraternity. Brotherhood, equality, and fraternity. And the motto of the French Revolution was exactly the same as the Freemasons' motto.
Yeah, again, that was a Masonic revolution. Covered up, of course, but evidence since.
They certainly didn't try to hide it. Yet all of this is hidden today. The Jewish influence is hidden today. The Masonic influence is hidden today. And you would just think that this was a Russian revolution of workers, and they somehow got it wrong, and it was a big failure. But you don't actually hear about all the political intrigue that was going on there and who it was serving, because you've got to ask that cui bono, haven't you? Who does it serve?
Exactly. But it seems in secrecy. And even down in Mexico, the Cristeros revolution, I didn't even know about it until I uncovered it. And again, you know, another Masonic war on Christianity.
Well, yeah, that's one link that they all had, wasn't it? They were all atheistic and anti-religion, anti-the middle class, and anti the intelligent people. I mean, even that revolution that they had in Cambodia and in China, they executed all the intelligentsia. People that wore glasses, they executed because they looked intelligent.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they always do, yeah. I mean, like in Poland, like, you know, if you were know the crime but being a doctor or a teacher, see you later.
Well, it's had a really bad effect on Ukraine, hasn't it? They've got a very low average IQ because all the intelligentsia were massacred. And that's
one thing I must say before we carry on is now we understand of the bankers' involvement in that revolution. When you look at World War II now, a massacre like Katyn in Poland could not have gone ahead without the permission of the bankers. And the same with the killing of the Tsar and the Tsar's family. People say, well, Lenin, when in fact it would have come from Schiff or the bankers back in America.
Schiff and Warburg, wasn't it? They were the ones that were pulling the strings.
Yeah, and that was a whole new picture then on World War II, because we kind of look at the Soviet Union as an ally, but, you know, we just put up with them, whereas they were being run by the West.
Yeah, once you know they were being run by these Masons, then you can see why they were allies and why Germany was the odd one out, because he got rid of all the Masons. removed them.
Exactly. And you can understand now why they hide the fact that Stalin was going to invade Europe with the biggest army ever seen, which Hitler managed to attack first. And that's been erased from the history books.
And we would have just continued still being under the Masons, but under a different form of Masonic government, I guess. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, Dennis. Go over time. Thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more Truthful Out Radio for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.